Hi, friends. This is Shadima, also known as the Type A Hippie, and this is the Type A Hippie podcast, ChiCast episode 17, which is perfect because we're in 2017. So happy new year, everyone out there. I am so blessed and so grateful to be on with Lisa Fredrickson. She is the founder of Breaking the Cycles, which she founded in 2008. And it's all about changing the conversations around underage drinking, secondhand drinking, which we'll get into, substance use disorder, substance misuse, mental illness, addiction as a brain disease, treatment, recovery, brain health, and much, much more. She has written over 1,000 articles covering all of this. Her website is breakingcycles.com, and of course, it'll be in the show notes. So Lisa, welcome and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and Happy New Year to you as well.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
How's it going?
It's going really, really well. It's a great start to the new year. I'm excited. It's always fun to have that switch over and kind of looking at this whole year as, wow, I wonder what's going to bring. So yeah, and happy to be starting it off with you. This is great. Thank you.
That's so kind. And yeah, I feel the same way. It's like a blank journal, right? Like I won a passion planner. I don't know if you've heard of passion planner before, but it seems like it might be up your alley. But it's part planner and part journal. And so they have prompts and you get to do like desire mapping and kind of figure out what your game changer is for the year and what you want to do, or game changer for the month, excuse me, and what you want to do this month. And then you map out what that looks like. And so I spent Sunday doing that and just kind of taking a look and taking stock because I had done that in the last episode of the podcast, episode 16. And so, yeah, it's really good to have you. And I totally agree with you in terms of what will 2017 bring and what will we bring to 2017, right?
Right. Absolutely.
So I was struck, I was doing some research and thinking about, you know, who I want to bring on to the ChiCast in terms of experts when it comes to substance use disorder and just recovery treatment, talking, you know, about this and having different conversations, because that's what this podcast is actually about. And I was struck by this notion and this idea of secondhand drinking. So can you tell us a little bit more about what secondhand drinking is and how you arrived at it and what that looks like so that people can determine if that's something that's playing out in their lives?
Sure. So it's a term to draw attention or to refer to the negative impacts of a person's drinking behaviors on other people. And so the common term is codependency or enabler for people on the family and friends side who have a loved one who drinks, whose drinking changes their behaviors when they drink. And then those behaviors are what that person is dealing with. And my story kind of backs up to 2003 when one of my loved ones entered a residential treatment program for alcoholism, and that plunged me into the world of being on the family side and being told that I was a codependent, that I was an enabler, that this was a disease. And I just balked at that because I felt that all I was trying to do was help, but I was also just so, so done. I was angry. My world was black or white. You're with me or you're not. It's a truth or a lie kind of thing. It was very, very shut down. And I hadn't realized that it had been almost 4 decades of my dealing with a number of loved ones' drinking behaviors. And these drinking behaviors refer to the lying or the cheating or the verbal, physical, emotional abuse, neglect, the being one way while drinking and another way when not, broken promises to stop or cut down, the constant deal making and the slicing and the dicing and the mincing of words. You had to figure out how to ask the sentence or question in a specific way in order to get the answer you were after. And it was just, it had just gotten so crazy, and I hadn't realized how bad it had gotten. And so it wasn't until 2009 when I then went into a 12-step program for the family side. I engaged in cognitive behavioral therapy with a therapist who understood the family side, and I did that for 3 years. And then I delved into this research because I had been researching and writing and speaking in women's history and the civil rights movement, but now I was shifting into, I don't understand this. And I had been anorexic and bulimic for 12 years and had learned to re-eat, so never bought into the disease concept of addiction because I'd learned to re-eat. You needed food to survive. You didn't need alcohol, so why couldn't they learn to re-drink kind of thing? And almost to set out to prove that it wasn't a disease. Talk about attitude. And anyway, it was the course of what I learned. And it's this emerging science that was, oh my gosh, this explains how a person develops addiction, how complicated it is to treat this disease, and there isn't just one way, and they're not, you know, willfully doing this to hurt me, which my first book in this area was called If You Love Me, You'd Stop, because that's what I believed. So the long of this, apparently, is that in 2009, I thought, you know, secondhand drinking sets up the connection to secondhand smoking. And just as when we had the science that explained what a person's cigarette smoke did to the health of the people in their sphere, people got the confidence to say, not in my house, not in my car, you know, not on my airplane kind of thing. And that's what I was looking for with the secondhand drinking, because the effect on the family and close friends is stress related. It's this constant hammering of the stress response, which is then setting up all these physiological changes. And those are what present as migraines, stomach ailments, sleep disorders, depression, anxiety. Many of the things we present with and then are treated by a medical professional for the symptoms, but not at the underlying piece, which is it's coping with drinking behaviors we don't understand. And I mean, in the sense that we think the person, it's the real person coming out, but generally it's not, unless that's how they behave, quote unquote, normally or when they're sober. It's instead behaviors that map around how the wiring connected, the drinking is the answer to a whole host of cues, and then became a brain disease, and how complicated it is to treat that disease. And anyway, I know I'm really on a long answer, but
yeah, it's all good.
Was to go, oh my gosh, and then I could start to forgive my loved ones, and I most importantly, or as importantly, could forgive myself, and then just start to move into a place of wow. And so that's where I wanted to start to share this in 2008, and I had been lecturing and speaking up until then, but that was when I officially formed the blog and started wanting to change the conversations and use this science base, because it's a non-emotional base, it's fact. And then sure, from there, people can take it, whether they do a mindfulness practice or they start, you know, a therapy experience or a 12-step program. It's just, it opens doors, you know. And so anyway, the secondhand drinking piece is the stress impacts of coping with other people's drinking behaviors. And you could be the innocent bystander. So if you get hit by a DUI, your life is upended. So is everybody else in your family. And secondhand drinking affects 90 million Americans. That's 5 times the number of people whose drinking patterns cause the drinking behaviors. And we are constantly at get them to stop drinking and everything will be well, and it's not. And that was the shift I was hoping for, just as when it was make the smoker stop and whoa, but instead it was, oh my gosh, whether the smoker stops or not, you need to take care of your health over here to protect yourself from the health impacts of secondhand smoking.
Absolutely. Well, what I think is so interesting is that you were talking about some of the physical ailments as well as emotional ailments that can come to a loved one of someone who's drinking and may have a problem with drinking, right? Because at this point, we're starting to learn more that it's a self-diagnosed illness, right? Mm-hmm. Even if we see something in a family member or a loved one, it's not up to us to decide, because even if we decide that they have a problem, they may not do anything about said problem.
Right.
But what I think was interesting is that you talked about anxiety, GI issues, so like stomach discomfort, depression, and possibly this fueling something else in the, on the part of the loved one. So maybe because they're anxious, they eat, right? Or because they're anxious, they may drink themselves. And these are some of the very things that the person that is drinking or using is often self-medicating for themselves. And
Absolutely.
so it is, and instead of, or even perhaps not even knowing or having the information or their experience, strength, and hope of someone else that has walked in front of them, not realizing. I remember I was watching, and I don't know if you saw this, it was last year sometime on Dateline, and Elizabeth Vargas came out as a person living in long-term recovery. She had about 4 years at the time. She utilized 12 steps, and she talked about this openly on Dateline, which I jokingly say, which is true, it's not even a joke, but I think it's funny that more people were watching her share her story than are listening to this podcast right now. But perhaps I'm going to be more mindful in 2017 about the words that I use, because I pray that more people start to listen to this podcast, because a lot of good information is here so that we can start to heal together. That said, when I watched it, I was struck with her thoughts of how she came to drink excessively. And it started, Lisa, with a glass of wine every evening because she was so anxiety ridden. And I mean, when you think about it, her role, she had been on some major, news publications, and in front, she was front and center and being. She was the anchor in a lot of different arenas, and she was on the ground during, multiple wars. And we were all watching Elizabeth Vargas. Little did I know, or anyone else, that's not close to her, what was really happening internally. And I always tell people when that I health coach and that I life coach, whenever I compare my insides to your outsides, I will always lose, because comparison is the thief of joy. And so I have no idea what your struggle is and what your story is, right? I just see that you look well put together. You have written 1,000 blogs on, things that you're
Well,
passionate about, And so it was just interesting to me that anxiety, and I've spoken with lots of, I personally don't drink. It's not healthy for me. And I still have many people in my life that drink, and some it looks like it's a problem, and others that's not the case. But many people that drink, especially women, that will start with just a night, excuse me, one glass of wine an evening or every other evening, have told me that they experience anxiety and they experience depression. And it looks like self-medication in certain respects, not in all. And of course, I'm not anyone's provider, so I won't make that determination. And I believe, to your point, it is a disease. And even if people don't believe it's a disease, it doesn't really matter, because those that are afflicted and believe it's a disease and treat alcoholism, addiction, substance use disorder as it is a disease, recover. I think it's interesting to, to your point about the side effects and the treatment of the side effects, and how we oftentimes don't go deep enough, right? We're not having these conversations where we can actually explore together, and people don't feel empowered with their providers to say what's really going on. Instead, people will sometimes look at that 40 questions pamphlet and lie to themselves and say, oh no, this isn't a problem. I don't know what my family's talking about. I'm good, and it continues.
Well, a couple things come to mind is what you're saying is for the stress response, it's an instinctual, hardwired response built into being human. And it's designed to set the body up to fight or run when faced with physical danger, which for early man, which was about the only danger we faced. Today, our danger is typically around emotion, and that emotion triggers that stress response, which sets up again the body to create a physical capability to fight or run. So it constricts the blood vessels in order you don't bleed out if you're injured. It tenses the muscles in the neck and shoulder in order to protect yourself from injury. It shuts down the digestive system to conserve the glucose to send it out to the muscles in order to fight or run. It's amps up the heart rate in order to pump the blood. And it's doing all of this within, I mean, you can't even count how fast it is sometimes. That stress response that makes you jump out of the way from an oncoming car instantly. So when we're activating that over and over and we never do the physical activity to expend what it sets the body up to do, all of that marinates in body organs, and that's how we get migraines, skin, problems, shutting down the digestive system over and over. That's how we get these, stomach ailments. And and then the anxiety and the depression around the change, the chemical structural changing happening in the brain around the toxic stress. So if we grow up in families where there's untreated alcoholism or drug abuse, secondhand drugging is the same idea, that sets up for a child this toxic stress piece, actually changing their brain architecture, which then makes that child's brain more susceptible to, if they do choose to drink, to minimize the symptoms, to medicate the symptoms, if you will. And so then the brain starts to map. And by mapping, what I mean is we have brain maps of neurons that fire together and wire together for everything we do on a routine basis. So it's practicing something, and then the brain adapts and says, okay, got it. You're doing this over and over. It must be important. We'll make this your default action. So when a person is presenting with anxiety or depression, if we were to start to screen and say, has a female in your life in the last year had four or more standard drinks in a day? Well, yeah. Oh, really? How often? Gosh, 3 times a week, probably. I know it's on the weekend. How many do their behaviors change when they drink? Oh, yeah. You start to open a conversation to help them understand what happens to this person, and then how they behave around it. And then we can say, you know what? We have a whole new body of research now that's helping us understand. I don't need to prescribe for you Zoloft, which is what happened to me. I was diagnosed with situational depression and put on Zoloft and then Prozac. That wasn't my problem. Sure. My problem was getting to the root of this. But then the other piece of this is that adverse childhood experiences, which is experiencing a parent who's untreated substance use, or a parent with untreated mental illness, or a mother being struck, domestic violence in the home. There's 10 of them in the ACEs study. Those are changing that child's brain architecture. So often secondhand drinking is the adverse childhood experience. And the hope with this concept is to open the conversation on how deep and wide it is, because a person who develops addiction, there's 5 key risk factors: childhood trauma, which is verbal, physical, emotional abuse, neglect, social environment, genetics, mental illness, and then early use. A child growing up in a family with untreated substance use has genetics, they have social environment, they have childhood trauma, and they very likely have mental disorder around that trauma. They have 4 of the 5 key risk factors for developing addiction before they have their first drink. So when we help families understand this, we can see how their loved one, developed this disease, not by willful, let me see if I can do this. Yes, it's a choice to drink, and it's a choice to drink, and then drink and drink. But once your brain crosses the line to addiction, the choice is no longer yours in the sense of saying, I'm only going to have 1 or 2 the way I used to, and for some reason I can't now. And you see, disease by its simplest definition is something that changes cells in a negative way. And when you change the cells in a body organ, you change the health and function of that organ. We can all appreciate lung cancer. That changes the health and function of the lung cancer. The symptoms are shortness of breath, weight loss, hoarseness, maybe coughing up blood.
Sure.
Disease of addiction changes the cell health in the brain and the function, and that is the organ that controls everything we think, feel, say, and do. Unfortunately, the symptoms of addiction are lying, cheating, stealing, breaking promises, hurting those you love the most, driving while impaired. The symptoms are so awful that we attach our feeling about the disease to the symptom instead of, this is a disease. The symptoms aren't like lung cancer, but nonetheless, it's a chronic disease, and we need to treat that and love the person as separate from their disease, the way we would love a person who has lung cancer as something separate from their lung cancer.
Yep.
So when we can kind of change this approach, we can appreciate you know, ourselves, if you find yourself drinking in response to stress, what is your stress or your anxiety? You know, go a little bit deeper, try to find that, and then find a different way to handle the anxiety so that it isn't around the alcohol. And one quick thing I want to just make clear, you'd mentioned 1,000 articles. That's 1,000 on the blog. I've written more like 800, so I just didn't want to leave it out there that I've written.
You're so honest. The program must be working in your life. That's awesome. So still, 800 penned by you, that's significant. Yeah. It shows your, you know, I was choosing what, I'm big into essential oils, and I was deciding, what do I want to put on today? And so there's an oil called Hope Oil, which is amazing, and it has some great oils in it. So it has ylang ylang, which is the oil of the inner child. It has bergamot, the oil of self-acceptance, and it has frankincense, the oil of truth, along with vanilla bean. But another one that I was alternating, and I might put it on towards the end of our talk, is one that I just made, and it has Whisper, which is the women's blend, and the oil of, I forget, but it, and then Passion, which is the oil of the inspiring blend, and it's all about finding your passion. And so I love when I get to talk to other people that are as passionate about something as I have found myself to be. Yeah. And it's such a beautiful thing, because that's when we can actually exact and be part of change, right? It's like, I don't just get to, I posted a quote by the late, great Muhammad Ali, and he says that service is the rent that we pay. I'm butchering it, but service is the rent that we pay for our space on this planet or on this earth. And, you know, I get to show up and be of service and not just take up space, which is such a beautiful thing. I mean, such a gift, right?
Yes. I'm making a note of it.
It is such a gift. I'll find the exact one and I'll put it in the show notes, but it is, it's just one of those things. I think I have it actually right here. So it is, service to others is the rent you pay for your room here on earth.
Okay. I like that. I like
that. So good. So one of the things that was interesting in what you just shared, and it's meaty. So Lisa and I already decided we're going to talk again. I don't ask my guests directly anymore. I just say, oh, this is what we decided. So we're just going to go with it. Right. So what was cool was when people, you know, something that I say on my podcast a lot is there's something really powerful and encouraging and hopeful. I think that's why I reached for the hope blend today. It's just that when I talk with other people that are passionate, there's hope. You know, we feel like we are part of the solution. You know, be the change that you wish to see in the world. I am a part of the change. You, my friend Lisa, are part of the change. And anyone who's listening is likely part of the change, you know, or has a deep desire to be. And so they're going to just do it.
Yes.
Is that, you know, when I come alongside you and I say, you know what, I've been there. Because when we talked a couple weeks ago, and we both discovered so many things that we have in common, and an eating disorder is one of the things we had in common, you know? And so for me to talk to someone, when I finally got a trainer, I got a trainer before I was actually ready to kind of be done with the eating disorder. And she did the requisite things, like she had had an eating disorder. And so she wouldn't tell me my weight ever. Like I would get on the scale backwards because that was part of what I needed, you know, because I was too stuck on the numbers. And so I was too busy, you know, kind of planning and managing. And it started 20 years ago when I was bullied and I didn't have very much control as a seventh grader, but I had control over what I put in my mouth and what I ate and what I didn't eat. And so that went unchecked for at least a year. And the doctor said to my mom, if she continues this way, she's going to develop stomach ulcers. And to this day, stomach discomfort is something that I have done a lot of work on, and it's still kind of part of my life. And so I'm working on releasing that and doing what I need to do in terms of processing with closed mouth friends and, you know, prayer, meditation and essential oils and yoga and so many other things that, you know, just being mindful, intentional. And so when, you know, we're talking, I work for a company and we provide primary care. And so a lot of our patients have said something along the lines over the 5 years that I've been with the company, this is the first time someone has actually listened to me and actually heard me, you know, instead of just telling me what to do. Because anyone, any doctor can say, you need to diet and exercise.
Right.
And then prescribe metformin for your diabetes. Very few will tell you what that actually looks like, right? And so what is moving your body look like and what is the benefit there? What, you know, what therapy, like, why aren't you, why don't you feel compelled to move your body? What else is going on? You know, we, I was talking with one of the providers and I was the clinical health coach for the patient, and through a series of questions, it wasn't so much that the patient was non-compliant, and that's a word that we have banned from our company. We don't use that word because it's not helpful.
Right.
It was more that the patient actually had two full-time jobs. So it's no wonder that they didn't sleep, which affects blood sugar, right? It's no wonder they weren't really eating because that affects blood sugar. It's no wonder that they were stressed. They have financial woes, et cetera, which is why, because who would, because they just want to. Most people would not work two full-time jobs, right? So it's just asking those questions and digging a little bit deeper, because I can always think that I know. I could be way off base. I could really actually have no idea what's happening. And, you know, to your point, recovery runs through families and so does the disease, right? So the disease of substance use disorder runs through families, and it's, I believe it's genetic in nature, unlike cancer, right? And recovery though can run through families as well. And so I know of plenty of people in recovery, because I always say this, we're all in recovery from something, or we ought to be, you know? And it's such a beautiful thing to see what it can look like for people once they are connected with not just the pill. And I am an advocate of pharmaceutical intervention as it's necessary, and it's not always necessary. But once they, you know, and also have a choice in their, treatment. When I was diagnosed with lupus, six and a half years ago. And so this May, it'll be 7 years. And my doctor prescribed me with medication. I was on it for 7 months. I decided that that wasn't for me. And he told me that he was going to put me back on if my labs did not come back to his liking. And I said, you can try. Because I knew for me, I wasn't going, I'm really sweet and spicy, Lisa, if you haven't gotten the idea, gotten the sense. But I was like, no, I'm not going to, you know, I didn't like the side effects and there has to be another way. And for me, that has worked. And I recognize that autoimmune looks different for everyone. And, but what was interesting was when I went to another rheumatologist, so I left him and I went to another rheumatologist, and I had an experience that was a negative experience with one of the residents. There were two residents that were there learning, right? They're in their residency. And one of them was awful. The other one was okay. And so I told my rheumatologist that I was not going to have the one resident in the room any longer. And she said, oh, she's only going to be here for a little while. And I said, no, she's not going to be here for any while, because I'm the CEO of my health care and you all sit on the board. So what that means is I'm the boss. And it's going to be done my way. And if more patients would talk to their providers that way, obviously respectfully, but I'm going to respect myself, you know, and do what I need to do. And you're not just going to tell me how it's going to be, because that's not, we can't do that anymore. That is such outdated thinking, right? Just like no one would dream of smoking a cigarette. Well, some people probably dream that they could smoke cigarettes on airplanes, but it's not going to happen because we just don't do that anymore. Or smoke in hospitals, or, you know.
We have this whole new body of science that helps us appreciate, no, You know, and when you were talking about autoimmune, that is so the brain mapping around stress, the trigger and then the reaction, the trigger, the reaction, the trigger, it just becomes automatic. And that constant hammering sets up autoimmune diseases. So to
For
your
sure.
point, when we get to the root of the stress, and that's a piece of it of my healing, getting to the root of the stress, is it changed our brain architecture, yours and mine, it sounds like, with your bullying. Because when you're in seventh grade, you don't have that cerebral cortex, the piece of it that we need, that discerning reasoning that says, that's not me, that's that person's problem. Everything is just, it's like a blank slate. It's literal. We have no way of, we haven't lived the experience to know we're going to survive it, you know, or it won't matter in 5 years. So we
Exactly.
map around that. And my mom is an alcoholic. I was sexually assaulted by a boyfriend's father as a teen. That's how I developed the eating disorders. But it wasn't until I addressed that trauma in my own therapy work, in my own healing, that I finally was able to really open myself to living. So even though I'd learned to re-eat from my eating disorder, I had never dealt with those traumatic underpinnings till, you know, I started in 2003. So as you're saying, we need to help medical professionals and help ourselves take a stand for our own health and say, no, this is not, you know, there's something else here. And I worked with Stanford's medical school students who were doing the eating and addiction disorder rotation for several years and was helping them reframe when their person comes in and they have anxiety or depression or migraines or, you know, all these physical manifestations. Ask this other question, because with 90 million Americans, likely, I mean, that's almost a third of the population. Likely they are affected by somebody's drinking behaviors. Maybe not right now in their immediate life, but they were affected as a child, or they were affected in the workplace, because a person who's affected at home comes into the workplace. You know, it's this huge ripple effect. So it was really an interesting their take on it, and it was exciting. It was hopeful. And there's now a move among medical practitioners, pediatricians, to help screen parents for their adverse childhood experiences, which will then make them a different parent. Myself, for example, I was as harmful to my children as their loved ones with a substance use disorder because of my constant stress activation in the what if and the, oh, maybe, you know, that fight, flight, freeze, or appease. That's not a healthy way to be. And so the message to them was, I don't think you can, because I was trying to protect them, or I don't think, you know, you're capable. And it was this different person where I was making them responsible for taking care of my feelings because I didn't even know how to do it. So that breaking the cycle, I didn't want them to go down my road, you know. So it was healing myself, and then he helping them get their own help, and then the three of us now, the healing we have, we're entirely different people, entirely different people, and it's very, very exciting that you can heal, you know, in your 50s, and it's just never too late.
It's so true. I read a book and I'm gonna have her on the podcast sometime this year, Erica Spiegelman. It's called Rewired. Have you heard of it?
Yes.
Okay. And so, you know that I'm a visual learner, and so when I think about, you know, the rewiring, and I'm getting ready to start teaching yoga anatomy to a yoga teacher training, which is awesome, and I just think about how we were created, right? And the creator of the universe and the plan that went into human beings, and then what we do to ourselves, sometimes by choice, sometimes beyond our control when it gets to that point, right? And then how we can come back. And so it's also like it is a story of hope and redemption, I feel. And I went to I'm learning, and you know, as I am kind of honing my own skills, bringing the clinical with the holistic. And I'm actually a pre-med post-bac student. I don't know if you knew that. So I know, on top of everything. So I am doing the pre-med studies, and then we'll be taking the MCAT and applying to med school and starting med school and finishing med school and residency
Absolutely
myself.
awesome. Awesome. Oh, wow. That's so marvelous.
So I'm grateful that I have my own experience, my own lived experiences, and then also a network of amazing individuals and just the information that I have now because, when you think about it, so I went to a chiropractor, oh my goodness, what year is it now? I went to a chiropractor in August 2015. And I mean, Lisa, I was in bad shape. Like I was so exhausted and just, and I know that a lot of doctors don't believe in adrenal fatigue, and that's what the chiropractor said was going on with me. And it was affecting some of my organs. And I mean, I could be sitting with you and I would just fall asleep. I was that, my body was that tapped out. And one thing that he asked me was about trauma, like in my body and trauma in my life, the like my birth experience. So I had to connect with my mom and I called my mom and I was like, well, how was it? What was going on then? All of this stuff, because one thing I know is I'm a certified yoga therapist and I also teach trauma sensitive yoga, is that all of these things are trauma within our body, right? And so it state like unless we address it, like you said, about whether it's DBT or CBT or therapy, traditional straight therapy or yoga or essential oils or, having a life coach or recovery, unless
All
we're right, all of the above, like we have to go backwards and go forwards, right, to move in this direction of healing and health and recovery. And it can be tough when people are unable or unwilling to do that. But it starts with a conversation and having a safe space, which I talked about a lot on the podcast, an earlier podcast. So I started the podcast in Thanksgiving, on Thanksgiving. And do you know I was able to record 16 episodes last year?
You know, that does not surprise me.
There's just so much good stuff to talk about and so many great people to talk with. So I couldn't help myself.
Love it. That's so great. And I think it's so funny that 16 ended on the last day of 2016 and 17 is the
Right?
first in. That's
It
so great.
is. It is. So is there anything, so Lisa, tell us before we stop for now, so it's just like a long pause, right? How can people get in contact with you and what do you do? It sounds like you are willing to travel or connect with people to do trainings because you mentioned that you do trainings, and you like to educate people in various forums. And how can people connect with you? On your website, on via email, do you have any social media? What, how do we get in contact with the great Lisa?
Thank you. So my phone number is 650-362-3026, and I welcome calls. They're free. A lot of times I just help talk people back from the edge, and I don't mean the edge of death by suicide, more just the edge of you're just at your wit's end, and try to help redirect them. I also then provide ongoing consulting services to people who want more long-term help with how they're restructuring. I'm not a therapist, so it's not therapy work, but just the knowledge I have after being studying this since 2003, I help redirect people. I do a lot of training, like you just said. One that I did recently was for physical therapists on the toxic stress, physical manifestation connection. So when we understand, it's one thing to train, teach somebody or physical therapy moves to relieve the physical symptom, but if you don't alter the stress, that will continue to trigger that physical manifestation and you won't have the optimum outcomes, for example. I mean, so I structure a number of talks and workshops and keynotes in different ways to meet that particular audience's need, but generally they're rooted in this new science as a way to give us a different basis for the conversation. And then I do work, so my website is breakingthecycles.com. My email is Lisa F, F like Fredrickson, so Lisa F at breakingthecycles.com. And I'm on Google Plus and LinkedIn and Facebook. So I welcome any opportunity to work with individuals. I'm a regular family program consultant at the Muirwood Adolescent Teen Center, so I'm pretty well versed in adolescent addiction treatment versus adult addiction treatment, because they're different things because of where the adolescent brain is at. Whatever I can do to help change the conversations, which was how I set it up in the original blog, was breaking the cycles, changing the conversations. Because, you know, when we think back to the 70s and we didn't have seatbelts in cars and there weren't car seats and nobody wore bike helmets and a lot of people smoked, and the way we viewed HIV. So when we shifted, as we got scientific information, look where we are now. You know, car seats are mandatory, helmets are mandatory, seatbelts are mandatory, because we found they save lives. And so having us understand this substance use disorders for what it is, it's a chronic, can be relapsing brain disease that needs individual treatment, that takes time, the same way we would treat heart disease or diabetes or cancer. We don't expect you to do it in 8 days. That type of thing can help us open up a whole new world, not only for the people who suffer from the substance use disorder, but the family members who love them. And we can change how we do law enforcement and how we do domestic violence and how we do sexual assault and how we do adverse childhood experiences by bringing in this deeper, richer, more nuanced, complex, you know, conversations. So I commend you. I'm so thrilled to be on your show, because when we talked a couple weeks ago, your enthusiasm for what you're doing and what you want to do with your show was perfect. So thank you.
Thank you so much. So you all got a lot of where and how you can reach out to Lisa. She is just as kind. She's been just as kind on this podcast as she was the first time we spoke and the first time I reached out to her. So if you have any questions, comments, concerns, definitely you want to connect with her, because she is a wealth of information, of lived experience, and will definitely do her best to connect you with local resources if that is something that you need and desire. So thanks so much, Lisa, as is customary.
Thank you.
I am going to open up into Humans of New York, the stories, because it helps to humanize that, you know, there are no others. I am you and you are me, and there's no us versus them. And so once we, like Lisa mentioned, listen to people and see, kind of meet them where they are to have a conversation, then we can be most helpful. So that's one of the reasons I started adding this. So we'll just do a couple stories today. This first one is a young person that appears to have alopecia. Their hair is thinning. And they say, I just always wonder if people are going to look at me normal and treat me normal. And then the person's asked, do they? And their response, most of the time, sometimes strangers stare at me, but if I stare back, they usually look away. And then the next one is, well, I'll do two more. I'm a Brooklyn assistant DA, so that's district attorney. I work on domestic violence cases, many of them homicides. Some of the crime scenes are just gruesome. It's the same stuff soldiers see in the war. I see this stuff. I smell this stuff. It's hard to get out of your mind. And even when I win a case, it's hard to feel like I'm making a difference. It's a never-ending cycle of violence. The offenders are so likely to offend again, and the women are likely to go right back to them or find themselves in a similar relationship. The work is so tough, and it feels like I'm not even making a dent. So that's a man with salt and pepper hair. And then this is a young girl, or a young woman, and it says, I fell into the wrong arms. I had no family here. And he was the one to say that he loved me. The hitting got worse and worse, but each time he'd come back saying that he was sorry and crying and begging me to forgive him. So I just kept praying about it until one night it got so bad that I had to jump through a window. So these are all stories. Sometimes they are positive stories and other times they're not so positive. And it is something that we can take a look at and see if any of it relates to us, and also just see how we are all so very connected. So, I honor the place within you where the entire universe resides. I honor the place within you of love, of light, of truth, of peace. I honor the place within you where when you are in that place in you, and I am in that place in me, there is only one of us. So I hope you all have a wonderful, blessed rest of your day, friends, on the third day of 2017. My name is Chidima, also known as the Type A Hippie. Namaste.